Welcome to Offline, a podcast about building a 100% online and remote expertise-driven business without the bullshit. Hosted remotely by me, Liston Witherell.
And me, Philip Morgan. You'll learn how we're building our businesses, what scares the shit out of us, and hear from our friends and experts who are building their remote businesses too. Welcome to Offline. Let's hit it and quit it.
I'm ready to do my thing. You ready to hit and quit it?
I don't want to call your name. I don't want nobody to know you're in here. That's that Doing It to Death on the JB's album.
Oh, yes. James Brown.
How you doing, Liston?
I'm good. How are you, Philip?
You clicked record at the perfect point to catch that.
I did. I caught that moment of magic.
Please leave that in, Juan.
That is being left.
I'm good. I'm sunbaked and wind-whipped, but doing well.
Yeah, so you're in Taos, New Mexico now. Am I allowed to say that?
That's right. Absolutely. No secrets here. I mentioned to my list today that my wife and I are moving here. I'm flying back to the Bay Area tomorrow to supervise packing up the house and go to a money mindset workshop on Friday.
Fancy. Who's teaching that workshop?
It's a woman named Michelle Masters. She wrote a book on money minds that I read part of, signed up for the workshop. We'll see how it goes. I expect to be a multimillionaire in a few years. So,
this is MichelleMastersNLP.com.
That's right.
I'm already extremely skeptical of anybody who weaves NLP into a pillar of their business, like their URL.
With good reason. I'll report back, though. I'll let you know. Maybe I'll be brainwashed and I won't be able to criticize it, or maybe it'll be a different outcome. I'll be happy to report back on this very selfsame podcast.
And of course, for the listeners of this podcast, we should clarify NLP in this context means neuro-linguistic programming and not natural language programming.
Or processing, yeah.
Processing, excuse me. Very different thing. Okay, cool. Well, I'm excited to hear about that. I was just talking to a friend who recently did Landmark Forum. You must be familiar with this.
I've heard of that, yeah.
It was really interesting. This is slightly off topic, and then we're going to get into innovation in your business. But let's just go for this tangent while I'm on it. I thought it was fascinating because the way Landmark works is it's kind of like Fight Club. Like, first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. They don't market very much outwardly, but they do. You are allowed to talk about it. In fact, they push hard for anybody going through it to tell their friends. And they frame it as like, you have an obligation to help your friends out. And if you don't tell them about Landmark, you really are doing them a disservice and almost like you're being a bad friend. And so you should tell them about it, which strikes me as very culty. But I also was sitting there going, what a amazing marketing plan.
I know, it's got that viral thing you're talking about, right? One person tells at least 1.5 other people.
Not only that, but they don't have to build trust nearly as much, which is enormous, right? So they're not having to spend nearly as many resources on convincing people that it's worthwhile for them. And that's just really interesting. Now, I don't like those high pressure situations they put people in, but I also found it to be pretty fascinating.
Cheryl had a friend in Denver who got way into that outfit. And of course, the friend like roped Cheryl into going to one of their meetings. And they were doing stuff like, you know, you can't get up and go to the bathroom during the session or whatever. And it just, from Cheryl's perspective, she relayed some of those cultish characteristics that you're talking about, like controlling people's behavior in really weird ways.
Well, and it also has this element of Scientology where there's like a path to advancement. Right. So the core thing is for you to believe there's something amiss in my life and I am maybe not inadequate, but underdeveloped in certain areas of my life. And Landmark Forum has the answer. And so while you're there learning, they're like, oh, by the way, a month from now, the next thing you need is starting up and here's how much it costs and here's how you sign up. And so they're sort of playing on this persistent inadequacy. And by the way, we're the only ones who have the answer, which is very intertwined into how Scientology works. That's the psychology of how they're able to make such a big business out of it. So I thought it was fascinating.
So everybody at home needs to go put on the nonfiction song Cult Leader and then return to this podcast.
All right. Well, so since neither one of us wants to be a cult leader ourselves, what we're talking about today is ways that you can build your business, and in particular, how you use innovation in your business and what sort of effect that has on the building of the business. So, Philip, why don't you walk us through your thoughts here?
So, I don't know, maybe it was a week ago, I tweeted thusly, and this is somewhat compressed to fit into a tweet. If your services business model does not explicitly include innovation, meaning a plan for funding innovation, a method for innovating, an expectation that innovation will contribute to additional revenue or profitability, then you're left with competing on meeting spec and lowering cost. That is, to be fair, a dogmatic way of stating my idea here. But I'm not sure that I'm going too far in what I'm saying. I think there is something to what I'm saying. It's just in that tweet stated somewhat dogmatically. That's something that I think is true, is that if you're not investing in what I'm going to call innovation, but I think we're going to elaborate on that a little bit throughout the course of this episode and add some sort of additional ways to think about the idea of innovation. But I stand behind this idea that if you're not investing in innovation, then you're left with a business model that is limited more or less to competing based on a few things, one of which might be we build what you want. We meet spec. We build really, really well. So there might be different ways you talk about meeting spec. You might say, thinking in terms of software developers who are largely who I work with these days, it's like, you know, we ship code with very few bugs or no bugs at all, or we do a better job of testing, or our code is more reliable, or those are all variations of meeting spec. Those aren't, in my view, and this might come across a little harsh, but those aren't innovation. Those are just doing a really, really good job. And there's a lot to be said for doing a really, really good job, but also you could think of that as the table stakes. The other competitive axis that's available to you, I think, is lowering cost. So that's slightly different than meeting spec. That's like, well, we're going to build what you need, but we're going to find a cheaper, maybe faster, but somehow cheaper way to build it. So that's the core idea. I need you to be a mirror to me, listening. Where am I off base with that? Or how am I oversimplifying things? Or what am I missing there?
Okay, so I'm going to practice my active listening skills. So my understanding is that you're saying there are three ways that you can build your business. One is to differentiate yourself with clear expertise and or some amount of intellectual property that you're counting as an innovation.
Okay.
The second is that you can compete on spec. You can meet spec, meaning your client tells you what to do and you're a pair of hands and you go do it. Is that right?
That's pretty close. I mean, you said there's three ways you can build your business, and
I was asking you to verify what you meant by meeting spec.
So meeting spec would be, we build what you want. I mean, that's the simple, dumb way to say it. Or we're really good at building the thing that you have designed, dear client, or that you have dreamed up.
Okay, understood. And then the third way is you can compete on cost, right? You're looking for, which can be a form of innovation, I would point out. You're looking for ways to drive costs down. So let me give you an example of that. I was interviewing this guy, Kevin, who runs a company called Leadium, Leadium. This is an unpaid mention here. And what they do is outbound sales and marketing. So you can hire Kevin and they'll put a couple people on your account and they'll find 1,000 contacts for you every month and call and email them multiple times in order to get meetings. And I was asking him sort of, how do you stand out in this area? And he said two things that were really interesting. And I would argue to you do count as innovation. but their ramification was not premium prices. Their ramification was lower prices. So he said, on the one hand, they've utilized existing software tools and built new software tools to have a competitive advantage in how they surface information. And on the second hand, they are using offshoring in order to have lower cost of labor, which you could also argue he may have innovated in his hiring process in order to ensure he's getting good non-native English speakers who are doing all of this in English. And so I would actually, I think this is a good counterexample to what you're saying, in that the innovation still does the main thing that you're looking for, which is to stand out and to clearly differentiate and position yourself. But in his case, the ramification is we're going to charge less. Therefore, we have a bigger market available to us. We don't have to spend as much time in the sales cycle. Clients are more willing to try us out.
I'm surprised that I've thought through this enough to have something to say to that, because maybe earlier in the process, I might have said, well, darn it, you know, you're right. There's a big flaw in my argument. Here's how I think about that, though. I think of what, is it Leadium?
Yes, the name of the company is Leadium. That's right.
So what I would describe Leadium as doing is absolutely innovation, but it's mostly internal facing. So what I mean is they're applying that innovation. Let's think of it as an innovation budget, right? This effort or time or money or all three that you might apply to the task of innovation. They're deploying their innovation budget internally. Now, it has consequences that affect lots of things other than the internal operations, like it affects their ability to price super aggressively, super low. I mean, when I call it internal facing, I mean the innovation budget is deployed on internal problems. And that's fine, but there's some interesting, if you kind of follow that down the line, there's some interesting consequences that come from that. If your innovation budget is deployed on your client's problems, not your own, and this is a bit of a nuanced area that we're getting into here, because you could, if you're Leadium, you could argue, wait, hold on, our innovation budget is deployed on our client's problems. Our clients have a problem that this stuff costs too damn much, and we're providing a better solution at a lower cost. So it is focused on their problems. And I would say, okay, but hear me out. Okay, I hear where you're coming from, but hear me out. If your innovation budget is deployed on the problems your clients have, rather than your own operational problems or needs, or just optimizing your own operation, then you have more to talk about with your clients than if the innovation budget is deployed internally. Should I elaborate on that? Does that make sense?
I think that does make sense. You have more to talk about. And why would I want that?
Because one of the main problems of marketing is that you're fucking boring to your clients, because you're talking about stuff that, obviously I'm being way over the top in how I say that, folks. But at its worst, you're being incredibly boring, because you're talking about stuff that's been figured out and you're just trying to make it your own. So I believe I've just described maybe 80% of content marketing, especially HubSpot's content marketing, right? I'm going to use that. I'm really going to pick on HubSpot, because I don't feel like I'm punching down when I do that. They're a big company. They can handle some criticism. But, you know, HubSpot's blog, their marketing is like, what is it? You know, 10 ways to get more listeners for your podcast, or I don't know. It just doesn't strike me as actually dealing with really difficult, interesting problems. Maybe I'm out of touch. I have to confess, listen, I don't read their blog. So maybe my criticism here is somewhat uninformed.
I mean, I understand why you chose HubSpot, because it's an example that anybody can relate to, but they're not trying to build an expertise-driven business. I do understand the point you're making.
Fair enough.
I do think, though, that if I am innovating in my delivery mechanism, I guess what you're saying is, other than a lower price, you don't have anything truly unique. Is that fair?
Well, let's say that I'm going to pick an imperfect example, but let's say that you're focused on the types of businesses that are being threatened by Amazon and that are just sort of have this existential crisis. What do we do? How do we respond to this? Amazon is just this 800-pound gorilla. I'm sure there's some businesses in that category. So if what you have to tell them is how you've innovated your delivery model so you can deliver some service to them at a lower cost, I don't think that's nearly as interesting to that business as saying something like, I'll just pick one of a multitude of examples here. We spent the last 6 months interviewing customers who have decided to not do business with Amazon for moral or ethical reasons. And we've noticed some themes in how they think. And we believe that we can help you use that to start to compete again against Amazon with some messaging that takes a really strong stance from a sort of values or ethics perspective. And we'd love to share that with you. Which of those is more interesting to that client?
Right. I see. But this really only applies if you're trying to run a true consultancy.
Yeah. I mean, there's plenty of businesses that can do a great business delivering an essentially a commodity service. So I guess I'm not really speaking to those businesses. I'm speaking to the expertise-driven business that does something that looks like consulting.
Well, hold on now. I think there's a stronger ramification, though. I think what you're actually saying is if you want to run an expertise-driven consultancy type business, the only way in the long run that you'll be able to do that is if you invest into innovating on things that are directly valuable to your clients, not just your internal delivery. So I'll give you an example. If I were running a podcasting service, right? Like we're having a podcast now, and I have someone who helps us with the editing, and he edits all my podcasts. He doesn't give me any big ideas about how to make my podcast better. But if he innovated on how to edit, which personally, I think within 5 years, he'll be out of a job because it's the model for creating software that can edit podcasts for you, I think to me is very obvious. How I would do that, just take some investment, but he'll be out of a job because he's not providing value beyond the edit, potentially. Sorry, Juan. But
well, Juan may not be editing your podcast for much longer, listen.
I know. Juan, I do love you. Trust me, the software isn't available yet. We need you here. On the other hand, you're saying if there was Gimlet Media who created the content, right? They have a special way of creating the content, or an outside agency that worked with, this is what Gimlet does. They work with eBay and they say, hey, we'll create this show for you and we'll do all the ideation with you and we'll position it and we'll do the artwork. And they have a special way of knowing how to increase the likelihood that they're going to make a hit. That's where the innovation comes. And that's how you can run a true consultancy. I think what you're saying is much stronger. I think what you're saying is if you think you're running a consultancy, but you're not investing and innovating in ways that are directly beneficial to your clients outside of price, but encompassing of insights, then you're not actually running a consultancy at all. And it's only a matter of time before you're in a race to the bottom.
Yeah. At a minimum, you've cut off your own air supply. The room that you're in is sealed. It's not going to get, it's just going to get more and more carbon dioxide and less oxygen. So, the first thing you said at the start of that was, I can't quite paraphrase, but it was really well said. Basically, you said, well, if you're not investing in innovation, you're either not able to provide consulting value or you're depriving yourself of the ability to keep doing that and eventually you become irrelevant. And I think that's true. I think I can stand behind that. In the podcasting example, there's an interesting specific elaboration I'll make on that. I forget how much I paid for it. It wasn't more than $20, this app on the iPad called Ferrite. And it already does some of what you're talking about. It can identify silences based on adjustable parameters, mark those for you, cut them out, and then tighten up the audio so that those silences are gone. It's a tiny, tiny little step towards what you're talking about, where the mechanics now that require judgment and skill are eventually, I believe, going to be turned into algorithms and turned into software that at first it'll do a terrible but passable job. I'm singing from Clayton Christensen's hymnal here when I say this, The Innovator's Dilemma. But eventually, that'll be a good enough solution for a segment of the market. People will move there, and then it'll get better and better and better. And then overnight, it'll seem like overnight, if you haven't been paying close attention, it'll be like, holy crap, software can edit podcasts now. Who saw that coming? That'll be how it's framed in some places. But there will be people who saw it coming, and there'll be people who've been working very hard to make it happen.
Okay, so here's specifically what I would do if I were trying to solve this problem with software. And I think it's pretty straightforward, right? It's exactly how Google built their transcription software. Do you know that story?
Fill me in. I might not.
Okay. So Google, this is back in the day when you had to pay to call 411. So there's, you know, you're not always connected to the internet, because otherwise, why would you call 411 for anything? Uh-huh. But you would call, I think it was 411 Goog, G-O-O-G. And you would say what you're looking for. And then it would connect you to a live operator, and they would say, are you looking for this, right? Whatever you said, usually. And you would say yes or no. And so what was happening, and you didn't know this at the time, and it was very ingenious, is their transcription software was attempting to transcribe what you said, feed it to a human being, and they would ask you, is this correct? And you would say yes or no. And if you said yes, they would mark it as the software did its job. And if you said no, they would type in what you actually said.
Oh, interesting. They were training it.
Exactly. It's machine learning. They're training it and they're telling it, did you get it right or wrong? And so if I were creating software for podcast editing, this is what I would do. I'd give it away for free online, and I would try to transcribe the audio. And then I would look for areas where there's ums or ahs or rights. And then I would start by, say, flagging them and just bringing them to attention of people. Do you want to edit this out? Yes or no? And you can click yes, and it just takes it out. And then over time, like, people would go in there, not the users, but people who work for the software company or maybe on Mechanical Turk or something. And they would say, here's a type of edits people are making, right? And they would categorize the edits. And then, you know, within a couple of years with enough users, it would be able to do 90% of the basic editing. So yeah, that's my thought.
Free business model gift for you, dear listeners, from Liston Witherell.
I have no interest in trying that. Seriously. So tell me, okay, we're sold on the idea of innovating. What in the hell do I do? So you mentioned a plan for funding innovation, a method for innovating, and an expectation that innovation will contribute to additional revenue. Now, maybe this is built into the method, but what should I try? Where do these ideas for innovation come from?
Well, you just innovate. It's easy. See you next week, Liston. No, I'm kidding.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's the question. So that's where I think we can start to make this a little more practical or actionable for folks. So, I mean, it's such a sort of almost a trope in business. It's like, oh, we need to be more innovative, or we need to think out the box. And then the efforts to do that are laughably bad. So I think it's an unsolved problem. Like, what is innovation? But I'll take a stab at offering a few. I'll frame it in terms of methods. And if you want to challenge me, I hope you do, as to whether these methods would actually produce innovation. One of the things that is true is the question is so much more important than the method by which you answer it. So some of this is based on Douglas Hubbard's work. Some of this claim that I'm making, this outrageous claim, is based on Douglas Hubbard's work. And some of it just a sort of recent general me paying closer attention to the whole idea of doing research. But I'll make the claim that the question you ask is the most important thing in innovation. How you answer it is flexible. There's a variety of ways you can answer the question. There are lean, scrappy, using small amounts of data to derive insights methods. There are certainly expensive, cumbersome ways of answering questions. So the same question could lead you down different paths when it comes to answering it. But I think it is useful to think of it in terms of those two things. What's the question I'm trying to answer? And how will I answer the question? So what the question is, again, is this sort of outsized factor in terms of its importance. And I think there's a couple ways you could hone in on some possible questions. One is to say, what is risky in the projects that I work on with clients? And I think there's going to be within that, let's say that you just listed everything that was risky. You could probably group your ideas into two buckets at that point. One is stuff that hurts you more than the client. And then there's stuff that hurts the client more than you, depending on how you're billing. If you're billing hourly, you're shifting a lot of risk to your client. So you might then take that list of what's risky and break it down into those two categories. What's going to hurt my client the most? And that might be how you prioritize the ideas. So let me stop there and ask if I'm making any kind of sense to you, Liston.
I think you are, but I was wondering if you'd be willing to share your approach to these things you're mentioning in your business, because I think it may help contextualize it for people in more of an applied way.
Okay. So let's say that someone hires me, Philip Morgan, to help them figure out how to specialize and develop a great market position for their business. They're excited about the idea. They see the potential, and they know they need help with that. Okay, so that's the project. I'm helping them decide how to specialize. Maybe after that, I'm giving advice about how to implement that decision, but let's just keep it focused on the decision. I would say one of the biggest risks is that we arrive at a decision that's actually a bad decision for them. Might be good for somebody else, but for them, it's bad in the context of their business, or sets them up for failure, or creates the conditions where they can't really implement on it. I think that might be one of the biggest risks. So what could I do if I'm thinking about innovation that addresses that risk, the risk of making a bad decision? Is that too simple?
No. I think that makes sense. So my follow-up question was going to be, how big should the question be? And so how can I make it less risky for people to make good decisions, or how do I reduce the risk of making a bad decision? That's a really giant question.
It is, for sure. I mean, it's contextualized to, it's not just any decision, it's a decision about specialization. So that helps reduce the scope of the question or the enormity of the question. But when I think about that, I think, well, there's kind of two responses to that question. I can imagine someone saying, well, I'll just get better at it over time. What I need is more client-facing experience. I need more iterations. I need to do this more for more clients. And I suppose there's nothing wrong with that. And so I suppose maybe I'm just impatient when it comes to this, but there's a part of me that's like, yeah, but you could shortcut that. You could, for example, try to find people who have gone through this process of specializing and they have made a decision and it's worked out well for them. And you could try to find out if there's any patterns around what they did. Is there something that they all or most all of them did the same that led to that outcome? Was there some factor that made the difference? That would be research, I think. That's what I would call it. What would you call it?
Yeah, I would call it research. And I think there's multiple ways to innovate. But so I'll share with you kind of how I interpret this in my business. And you can tell me if you think I'm on the right track. So why do people come to me? They want their teams to be better at selling services in kind of a complex sales and delivery environment. And one of the key questions that I come to, in order to help them do that, I need to really understand what makes people buy stuff. Like, how do they make buying decisions? It's not about selling more effectively, really. It's like, how can we deliver an experience that's most closely matched to how people like to buy? And it is contextualized to selling services in a complicated environment, but it is still a gigantic question, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And I suppose the following is generally going to happen. You're going to say, okay, well, that's the question. I think it's an important question. That's one of the things Douglas Hubbard points out multiple times, is that we're usually wrong about what the right question is at first. And I don't really actually have a lot of advice about this right now. So this is something I haven't figured out or arrived at best practices around. How do you get better at asking the right question? But generally, we ask the wrong question, or we're somehow biased or predisposed to ask questions that are easier to answer. And that causes us to ask the wrong questions. So I think it's going to be pretty common for folks to say, okay, well, I like this idea of shortcutting learning and getting better at delivering value to my clients faster by using research as a tool to innovate. And so I've got a question and I'm going to start answering it. And I think sometimes the question in the abstract might seem fine. It might not seem too big. And then you start down the road of trying to answer the question through research. And that's when you really find out the question is too big. Because everything you do as you're trying to answer it seems inadequate or seems frustrating or seems to not work. I think that's a feedback mechanism, perhaps a subtle one, that your question's too big. It's too broad. It's too expansive.
Okay. Do you think I'm on track with my question? Did I do a good job of demonstrating how I might invest in innovation?
Let's have you rephrase the question again.
So the question I'm posing is, why do people buy expensive services in a complex sales environment? What makes them decide to buy?
Awesome. I love the question. Let's, just for fun, mostly, let's try to find ways to narrow the scope of it and create these sort of sub-questions that are still relevant, but let's maybe think of that as a multi-part question. So one sub-question might be, what causes a client to agree to a project that is bigger than the budget they had in mind?
Ooh, that's a different question.
Well, is it? Or is it, if you can imagine answering a series of sub-questions, okay, maybe that's not the right sub-question. But you see what I'm trying to do is kind of break this question down into smaller components that might be easier to answer?
Sure, yeah. If we had I'm imagining like a pie chart, which is like all the reasons people buy, that would be a very small slice of it.
Okay, so you're actually the expert here. So I'm going to challenge you. Can we decompose this larger question down into a set of smaller questions? Like, what comes to mind when I sort of challenge you with that?
So in other words, let me rephrase my question again. How do people make buying decisions in a complex service and buying environment? Mm-hmm. So I think a subset is like some assumptions that I may have about, or some things I know to be true about how people make decisions already. And so for instance, one would be, well, they have to trust you, right? They have to feel like if I'm going to put my job on the line, if I'm going to allocate part of my budget, if I'm going to allocate part of my agenda and bandwidth this year, it better be good, right? And so I have to trust you. So I think a subset or a smaller piece of that question is, what causes people to trust people in business transactions?
Yep. A related sub-question might be, what causes a breach of trust or a loss of trust or a sudden change in the trust level?
I like that.
Are we still in alignment with our larger question, with this sub-question?
Yeah, I think so. So tell me about the method. Let's take this more specific question, what causes a breach of trust or a sudden change in trust? What sort of method might I apply to this? And there's no way to know, will our answer be innovative? But what would my approach be to try to answer this question?
There are three approaches. I say that now because I'm about to go on a tiny tangent and I don't want to forget that I'm setting up this three approaches idea. There's more than three approaches. There's three categories of approaches. So really quickly, you said something super important. Innovation is often wasteful. It might be best to have that be your expectation. It won't work. I think of it like, I have never been able to find this quote, but I saw a quote a long time ago attributed to George Bernard Shaw talking about how like really great photographs are like the salmon swimming upstream. Like most of them don't make it. So photographers, even professional photographers, often make a lot of photographs. Very few of them are great. And that's just, it's all in the game. Like no one's surprised at that. I imagine if you talk to your uncle Liston, maybe we've talked about this before, he would probably say that. He's like, yeah, I'm not surprised that 999 out of 1,000 photographs are not worth showing anybody.
In fact, when I asked him, how do I take better photos? He said, take more photos.
Okay. So he's in alignment with this.
He is. And I asked him about one particular show that he did where he took pictures of automobiles at famous auto museums. And I think it yielded something like 50 photographs. And I said, how many photos did you take in order to get your final set? And I think he said something like 15,000 or 20,000.
Okay. I feel like I'm not that far off with my 0.1% claim.
Right.
And for folks who don't know, Liston's related to a, I would say, famous art photographer, Huntington Witherell. So innovation's wasteful. And that's why I feel like in the way that I said this in my tweet was, you have to commit to it because it's wasteful. In other words, if you're like, well, let me try this, and if it doesn't work the first time, I'm going to call it a bad idea. And when I say it, I mean some form of innovation or some form of research. Well, just don't even try. If you're setting yourself up that way, you're setting yourself up to have a disappointing, sort of like lottery-like experience. It's like, well, I'm going to go play the lottery, and if I don't win the whole time, I'm going to say, well, that was a waste of time. And you would be right with the lottery. I think your chances in the context we're talking about here are actually much better than the typical lottery. But it's wasteful. It's not going to work every time. And you just have to plan on that. And that's why I think you need to treat it like a fixed ongoing expense that you budget for in your business, because it may not yield results the first time. I still think it's worth doing, because I think it's one of the things that makes the difference between the really high-performing consulting firms and the rest. Anyway, methods. There's three of them, or there's three categories or groups. There's surveying, there's interviews, and then there's collecting data that sort of already exists and interpreting it in some way that's relevant to your question.
And so this is innovation in the context of consulting companies.
Oh, absolutely. Everything I'm saying is in the context of consulting companies.
Okay. So surveys, interviews, and collecting secondary research, or yeah, basically you're doing secondary research by collecting primary research and then coming up with insights from that.
Or maybe not even primary research. I'll give an example of that third one, since it might be the one I did the worst job of describing. There's a analyst firm called Red Monk. Every year they produce a publication that is, I think, it's ranking programming languages by popularity. So their data source is GitHub. They may have others, but that's one of their primary data sources. So GitHub is this, I mean, most of the listeners to this program, I think, will be acquainted with GitHub. But it's a public repository. Not everything on it is public, but there's a lot of data on there. So what Red Monk is doing, I don't know exactly how, they're using that as their data source, and they're interpreting that in a way that's useful. So they're doing some data crunching. They're doing some data gathering. I don't know. Maybe they're scraping stuff from GitHub. Maybe they're programmatically sort of walking the entire GitHub public repo and looking at repositories there and figuring out what programming language is in use and looking at lines of code. I don't really know how they're doing it. There's some sort of semi-algorithmic layer at play in what they're doing, but they're taking this data and they're making it useful. That's all. I mean, it's very simple to describe what they're doing. They're just choosing to do the work that nobody else chooses to do. And in so doing, they're producing value for at least their clients, if not a broader set of people. So that's an example. It could also be taking data that other people have put together through research and slicing it up in different ways or interpreting it in different ways or combining it with different data.
Yeah. And so, okay, big question for you here. One thing you mentioned is that there should be an expectation of planning for paying for this, right? It's not going to be free. And not only will it cost you time, but there will be hard costs to it. You may actually have to pay something. So if I'm running a survey and I'm targeting 1,000 respondents, I may have to pay $7 per respondent. So that's going to be a $7,000 study, which actually is kind of low, I would say.
That's quite low, actually.
Right. We probably want to think more on the in the lines of like $20 to $30 per respondent. So what percentage, I'm guessing, obviously we could spend any amount on innovation, like we could make up any number, but do you think of it as a percentage of my revenue as kind of a benchmark for how to think about how much to allocate?
No, not at all. I think of it more like going to the gym, which I haven't been in a while because of this moving, which is a lame excuse. But to me, going to the gym, if I show up and I lift some weights that are heavy and I try, I'm successful. Now, that's obviously not going to get me into some bodybuilding competition, which is not my goal, by the way. But obviously, that level of commitment is insufficient for the outcome of I'm going to be in a bodybuilding competition, right?
Right.
Or anybody at all is going to be impressed when I take my shirt off. Like that's another goal that someone might have. And the level of commitment I'm at, it's not going to get me to either of those goals. But what it will get me is avoiding the slow decay of aging or altering it in a way that I'm happy with. So that's enough for me. So what I'm really saying here, by way of this a terrible example, is it kind of depends on what your goal is. At a minimum, I would suggest that you're doing some sort of project quarterly, and you might do it in a way that's more demanding of your time and less demanding of your wallet. There are very sort of lean, scrappy ways to do these things that don't require, to use the example of a survey, don't require you plunk down $40 per response, which is the amount I was quoted by Qualtrics, a big survey platform that also has a services arm that will do recruitment for you. They priced it out reaching self-employed software developers for whatever survey. I mean, the survey is up to me. So it could be an easy way to waste a couple $1,000s, but $40 per respondent. And then I asked them on the sales call, what's the biggest amount per recruit that you've ever seen? And it was over $100 per recruit for some sort of specialized doctor that someone wanted to survey. So it can be very expensive. It doesn't have to be, though. With a budget of, I'll throw out some numbers that I think are reasonable, 10 hours a week and $300 a month, you could do some fucking impressive research. So it doesn't have to be expensive.
And what goes into that $300 number? Now I'm personally curious, but I'm not asking for any of our listeners.
That's fine. We really do this podcast for us anyway. No, I'm kidding about that. Hopefully it's of use to at least some segment of our audience. Here's a sort of stack of tools that you might use. And I'm just going to pull from what I've been doing. So a decent survey platform is getfeedback.com. So that's, I think, going to be $100 a month. That can do a little bit more advanced stuff like answer piping. I don't want to get too much into these, into the weeds with stuff like that, but someone answers question two in a certain way and you want their answer to alter question, any downstream question, really. Question three, question five, seven, whatever. That's answer piping. That's not present in most of the free products. So you have to pay a little bit. So let's say $100 a month for that. You can use LinkedIn as an outreach and recruitment tool for a survey. So you're looking at $80 a month for Sales Navigator. We're up to 180. And then a tool for automating the outreach is really helpful. Not necessary, but it's super helpful. Reduces your time budget. So Linked Prospect is one I've been using. That's $100 a month. So what are we at, 280?
Yep.
Yeah. So that's where my $300 a month number came from.
Yeah. I think one alternative approach you can take, and so I basically agree with you, but one alternative approach that I might include in that $300, well, actually, if you wanted to spend a little bit more than that and prospect off of LinkedIn, there's a tool called Prospect.io, which you can use to scrape profiles off of LinkedIn, which I guess is technically against their terms of service.
Probably.
But it'll resolve an email address for those people and at least scrape their information. So you could hire a VA to find a good email address for them. And then I use MixMax for one-to-one email automation, but Mailshake is totally viable. And Prospect.io even has a built-in way of emailing people. And that can be another way to collect feedback. And I don't know how they get doctors to agree to this, but I know some people will just bribe people and they'll say, hey, I'd love to buy you a cup of coffee. Like, I'll send you a $5 Starbucks gift card once you complete this, which adds to the cost, but also adds to the likelihood that people will actually do it and maybe cuts down on your recruitment time.
Oh yeah. There's just like dozens of, like, if you just had, let's call it $500 a month, right? If you had that budget, there's just like dozens of ways that you could deploy that. Now, it's going to take your time and you're going to have to be committed, but you could deploy that in a way that produces spectacularly interesting findings. Not for CNN's not going to report on what you're doing, okay? Harvard Business Review is not going to be knocking on your door, but the kinds of clients that you're trying to reach, if you're narrowly focused enough, $500 a month, you could produce spectacularly interesting stuff for them. And as Liston points out, the means by which you do it actually look a lot like outbound sales in the context of either trying to recruit interview subjects or people to respond to a survey. So it's like simple, dumb stuff. You just say like, hey, will you take my survey? Obviously, it's not quite that simple, but it's conceptually, it's not any more complex than that.
Yeah. And podcasting, since you're listening to this, dear listener, one use of podcasting can be to interview people in your market. You drop a list of questions, and rather than sending them to an online survey, you actually have a conversation, ask the same questions every time. They get some publicity out of it, and you make a personal connection in the process. And if you're willing to do that every week, you end up with 52 very long form survey responses that becomes a data set also.
Absolutely. I'm undertaking that same project myself. The goal in my case is to write a book, and the research for that book will be a podcast. So instead of the research being private notes, I'll publish the research as a podcast. And it's exactly what you said.
Yeah. And for my modern sales podcast, I'll just make that a little bit more concrete. Back to this original question, which I'm attempting to answer through research, is what causes people to buy in an enterprise environment? Like, how do they make those decisions? When do they realize they might want to buy something? How do they decide who to contact? Once they decide who to contact, who's involved? What's their involvement? What do they have to say about it? What do different parties want to know? Like, there's all these questions, right? So I have different groups of people that I want to interview. And so rather than asking salespeople, how do you sell better, which is not a very interesting question to me, I'm going to go contact people who are in buying roles in corporations who make 6, 7, 8, 9-figure purchases on a regular basis and ask them, how do you guys buy?
Yeah.
If I wanted to sell you something, what should I do? What shouldn't I do?
Yeah.
And so I have different subsets of people, people in talent development, people in marketing, people in sales, people in the C-suite. And I'm going to go to them and ask them to be on my podcast. And I'm going to ask them all the same questions. And then I'll be able, I mean, really after 5 or 10 interviews of each title type, I'll be able to make a composite and say, here are the themes that I'm picking up on. And that information, I guarantee you, will be interesting to my training clients.
Oh, for sure. For the folks at home, I want to hammer on a point here that maybe I've already hammered on, but I just feel like it needs to be hammered to death. We are not talking about what you would need to do to develop the next miracle drug or find a cure to cancer or convince the government of China to change its policy on something or convince any government to change its policy on something. Or, I mean, you see where I'm going with this, okay? This is not what we're doing. And so it's easy to forget that what we're trying to do is help clients in a very niche market make better decisions. And to do that, you don't need a PhD level approach to this. I mean, a high school level approach is more what we're talking about. And I really want to own that. There is absolutely a place in the world for exceedingly high levels of rigor. And folks in doing that stuff, if they forgot that our goals are different than theirs, they would laugh at what we're doing. Rightly so. But again, only if they forgot what we're doing. If you remember what you're doing, again, what you're doing is trying to reduce uncertainty in a very specific context. And I'm not saying to be sloppy, but I'm also saying that there's a lot of ways you can achieve that outcome using what seem like pretty informal, casual methods. So I just feel like hammering on that point again, because I think it's so important. It gives us permission to do things that we don't think we have the training or expertise to do. And to me, that is how you get through the fucking side door, is you give yourself permission to do it instead of feeling like, well, you know, that's out of reach for me, or that's not my job, or I don't have the training or whatever. I wonder, I think about Gary Vaynerchuk talking about eating shit. And I think you're going to eat a little shit listening as you're trying to get those podcast interviews with C-level folks. But I'm confident you're going to land some of those interviews. And like you said, you don't need a whole lot of them, 5 or 10. And I bet you start seeing a whole lot of consistency in the answers. And you've got enough confidence from your data set to go to your clients and say, yeah, you're going to run into exceptions, but have you talked to 10 CEOs and asked them the same set of questions? Probably not. So I have a little more insight into this than you do. And I can tell you the following things are likely to be true.
Yeah. And so I think this is a time when people will start to potentially ask, well, how much is enough? And if you are asking that question, I recommend you go read How to Measure Anything by Douglas Hubbard, because he has much better answers than I do. In fact, I'd be quoting him if I told you, but the shorthand of it is exactly what Philip just said. If you're talking about having one-to-one conversations, 5 conversations will move you so much closer to a good answer than 0. And it doesn't need to be 10 or 20 or 50 or 100, which I think is what most people think. It doesn't need to be that many. You're going to see common themes arising much faster than that. And in fact, when I was doing conversion optimization work, that was kind of our magic number, is we were looking for about 8 to 12 representative random sample interviews. And by interview 4, we're like, I know what they're going to say.
Yeah.
So
I'll jump in here and say, if you're doing more quantitative stuff, like you're trying to measure something, and what we're talking about with interviews is a form of measurement, but it's much more qualitative. But if you're doing quantitative work, I know this because I sat in on, it's going to sound so weird. The Military Operations Readiness Society hosted Douglas Hubbard for a free to the general public webinar, 2 hours. So obviously I joined that because, like, hell yeah, I want to hear that guy talk for 2 hours. So I know from his presentation that if you're doing more quantitative things, like, here's an example. What is the budget that Fortune 500 firms deploy for some purpose? I don't know, anything. But as long as the question is specific enough and the sample pool that you're pulling from is homogeneous enough, 30 samples is about the magic number in that context. Beyond that, you have to add another 120 samples to reduce your error rate, I think, by half. So you start having to, it's almost an exponential thing where you start having to collect almost exponentially more data to get small reductions in your error rate and therefore small increases in your confidence. So at about 30, you've really closed the gap between knowing nothing at all and knowing kind of a lot. So again, it reinforces this point both Listen and I are making. it just doesn't have to be a lot of data. It just has to be the right data gathered from the right place in a reasonably correct way. And you will learn so much. And if your goal is to use that learning to help your clients, you will be innovating on their behalf. And guess what? They didn't ask you to do that. The way they pay you back for doing it is in premium rates.
Boom. Well, I think that is the perfect place to leave it, my friend.
I think so too. Thanks for letting me rant on this. In a way, it was a long form advertisement for Douglas Hubbard's book. I'm so glad you pointed that out. I never mentioned the title of the book, How to Measure Anything. It's not the easiest read, but it's so valuable.
Indeed. Highly recommended. It's linked in the show notes. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you back here next time.